what you feel when you're doing that, and I really paid attention because I got to do this 5 times. So I really, the more I did it, the more I would, the last flight in particular, I really paid attention to physiologically how is it feeling. Is, you know, when you come back into the G field, you're disoriented, and what I, and when you first hit gravity, you start moving your head again, everything starts spinning. You're very dizzy. And I noticed when I grabbed the stick and flew it on the last time, when I was flying around the hack and landing it, I was really paying attention, and I noticed the cockpit was in a slow spin. Like, so you're in terms of your flying abilities, you're only about 60 or 70% of your, what you normally can do when you're flying. And so that's why the training's so important to be able to do that. So that, like I said, I could talk for hours about it, but that's quick and dirty.
Yeah.
You know, we need to back up one more time, Emily, if it's okay. On the pre-launch stuff, we didn't talk about the very last couple of minutes of the launch time. And when you get to that point, you close, they have you close your visors and you go on oxygen in your suit. And that's when things get real. That nervousness that you'd ignored before really comes in, and you start thinking, this is real. We're going to really launch on this rocket here in a couple of minutes. On my very first flight, there were 4 rookies on the flight. And there was an experienced commander and an experienced mission specialist, too, who's like the flight engineer for the flight. And that, his name was Story Musgrave, that you may recognize. He's an aviator also. But Story was the most experienced astronaut in the astronaut office at the time. And I think this was his 5th flight at that time. And Story was sitting right in the center between the commander and the pilot. And we had a lot of that banter going on that I talked about before that gets rid of the nervousness, and you're joking around. And right before we closed our visors, Tom Hendricks, who is our pilot, he sort of looks around and he noticed that Story wasn't participating in this banter. And Tom says, Story, you're awfully quiet. What's wrong? And Story said, I'm scared to death. it got really quiet.
And he's got this wonderful voice when he says something like that.
Yeah. But, you know, the most experienced guy, and we're all joking around, and he's really serious. And, so we were very quiet the last 2 minutes before we launched. And the only thing I'll say about entry, because Steve did a great job of describing the whole process of entry and landing, on that same flight, coming back, I was going to sit on the mid-deck down below, so you don't really see what's going on upstairs where they're doing the flying part. But I was getting a crewmate ready for an experiment for landing, and it involved that vestibular upset that you have, and I was putting a lot of sensors on his head and near his eyes, and we were late getting this done. So I was still, he was sitting in his seat, I was standing up, putting all these sensors on him, and we were really way behind. And we started picking up G, and
you were still out of your seat.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The commander couldn't see me, so he didn't know. But I was struggling at the time because you really do feel heavy at that point. And I said, "How many G's are we pulling?" And Tom said, "A half." And I thought I was going to collapse on the floor. It really is amazing how you feel coming back, and how you have to readjust, and your all your sensors in your body have to reacclimate. Yeah.
You know, from the control center standpoint, the real high stress time for entry, because you train incessantly for the actual dynamic entry, the real high stress time is the weather call.
Oh, yeah.
So, as he said, you've got to do the deorbit burn about an hour before you land. And generally, you're trying to hit KSC, Florida, and you're going to hit it right at sunrise so that you don't hit thunderstorms. What, they start about 9 o'clock? You live down there, right? And they go the rest of the day. So you're shooting for this narrow window. Well, of course, that's when you get fog, and that's when you get, you know, all sorts of weird stuff. And so the flight directors are just pounding on our weather guys for this prediction of, are we go and forecast go for an hour and a half from now? So imagine you live in a very foggy, an area that's Tennessee fog, and you have to make your go-no-go decision an hour and a half in advance. Once you've said go, these guys are going to burn, they're coming down, and there's no abort. You're going to land regardless of what the weather is.
Yep.
And we didn't want to fly the orbiter through precipitation or anything like that, so it was a pretty stressful time. And what we did, when you weren't working the mission, you sat up in what we called the crow's nest or the director's suite, which was some windows up above where all the senior management or senior flight directors would sit, and we'd heckle the guys down below that were making the decision. And that was kind of that nervousness thing you were talking about, because there was nothing else we could do about it. But, you know, we wanted to make sure they made the right call. But we'd sit up there. It was kind of like those two Muppets that sit up in the upper thing, you know, kind of heckling what they were doing. They couldn't hear us. They couldn't hear us. But so, that was always fun.
So, Paul, did I tell? I think I'm the only shuttle commander to ever log an instrument approach.
I think I remember that.
So on my last flight, and this weather call is really hard in Florida because it's Florida weather changes instantly. And the weather criteria for landing was 8,000 feet ceiling and 5 miles vis. And we never flew the shuttle through any visible moisture. So there's all kinds of rules about thunderstorms within a certain distance and all that kind of stuff. And when I was running the astronaut office, I did a lot of weather flying, but I was flying this flight, and they made a weather call, which has to happen about an hour and a half before you land. And then you just hope you got it right. And so they deorbited me, and I'm coming in, and then I get a call at about Mach 5, and they said, oh, the winds are 21 gusts to 29. And I think the shuttle limit was it 20?
I think it was 20, yeah.
It was 20 knots. And so, great, 21 gusts to 29. Well, this is going to be fun. And it pretty much held and landed. But then they said, it's a classic, 21 gusts to 29, but they're straight down the runway. How many of you ever flown in gusty winds that they were always straight down the runway and never turned into a crosswind?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew, and I told my crew, I said, heads up. If they're saying it's down the runway, they are lying. So be ready. We're going to get a crosswind or something. And so then I roll out on final at 14,000 feet, and I look down, and the field is totally obscured with a cloud layer. So it's like overcast. And you're diving at 20 degrees. I have no idea what the ceiling is. And normally you have to make a call to the ground. You say, you know, Houston, field in sight, Houston.
Yeah.
Which I called the ground and said, hey, Houston, it's going to be a while before I call field in sight. So we broke out at 2,500 feet.
Wow.
And fortunately, I knew I had good nav and good guidance. We used what's called microwave landing system, super accurate. And I knew I had good, you know, we had GPS on board, so I knew I was good, but broke out, you know, picked up, runway was right there, start my pre-flare, and then in the final flare, and I got a big cross, like 15, and we had a 15-knot crosswind limit, too. It was 15, 16, plus all of this gusty winds, and so I'm in this big yaw, and the shuttle was if you ever saw it, it was a delta-winged vehicle, and so if you wanted to pitch up the shuttle, pull back on a stick, what the vehicle would do is the back end would drop, create the lift, and then you'd lift. So what that means is, if you're below about 30 feet in your final flare, and you want to correct your descent rate, if you pull back on a stick, all you're going to do is drive the main gear into the runway harder. And so you better be set up by about 30 feet, because you pretty much go open loop from there, because it's not the best flight control system. Yeah, or your PIO, which we had happen a few times. And so came down, so I had this big old crosswind at 30 feet, and I had it set up, and then those winds did shift to directly down the runway right at 30 feet. So you all know what happens then, right? You got a big crab in, you're at 30 feet, and now you don't need it anymore, so guess what? I'm going this way. And so I had to correct that and hold off, and somehow it worked out. But it was. But I came back and I figured, hey, since the minimums are 8,005 and I didn't break out to 2,500 feet, I think that's an instrument approach.
It's an instrument approach.
So I logged a 0.1 weather.
And we finally got the crosswind DTO.
And we got
after
the crosswind DTO.
After 20 years,
yeah,
we got
exactly.
the crosswind DTO.
But
exactly.
Steve, there's somebody else who's claimed an instrument approach.
Who is that? They're probably lying.
Dave Walker. I was there. I saw it. But he only had about 10 seconds of in the cloud time.
Okay.
But he still claimed it as an instrument.
He claimed it. He logged it too.
We were supposed to go to the Kennedy Space Center for landing, and the weather call, Paul, was that it was going to be bad there, so we were going to go to Edwards out on the West Coast instead.
And you ended up in the weather
and
in Edwards.
When we got to Edwards, the weather at the Cape was perfectly clear and everything was nice, and there were all these scattered clouds, and Dave wasn't speaking kindly of the weather guys or the flight directors at the time. And he did his, on the heading alignment circle, the hack, he passed through a cloud and he claimed an instrument approach.
He was on a segment.
Wait, no. If he was on the hack, that's not...
It was the initial.
It's got to be from the final approach fix in.
I'm going to have to speak up for Dave, because Dave would ask you, what, all that other stuff about the crosswinds and breaking out at 2,500 feet, was that an excuse for a hard landing?
It was a good landing.
Okay. It was a good landing. I remember his numbers.
And, you know, they keep track of the numbers.
I got the number.
There's a lot of pride in shuttle commanders.
All right. That leads me right next to my next question. All right. Tell us. Make sure I'm getting it right. Tell us about a time, and you guys can elaborate on this with each other as much as you want. Tell us about times that maybe the unexpected happened and what you guys do to remedy it during, could be during any mission.
Oh, well, the unexpected, you know, we train for the unexpected. When we're doing simulations, and we spend, at every flight controller or flight director spends at least a day a week in the control center doing generic training or flight control or flight specific training. And like I always say, when you go over there for 8 hours of training, if you've got, if every of the, one of the dozen front room disciplines has one failure, it's pretty much a waste of their day, because that's easy to work, right? But you have to remember that the flight director and the CAPCOM are working 12. So if everybody gets two failures for the day, it's still a waste of their time. I mean, it's just boring, right?